Thank you. So the talk I will sort of divide into two parts, and the first part I'll do with transparencies, and the second part will be with the blackboard. And that's why half the names are in red. The first part will refer to more or less everything that we were doing in Cambridge connected to Polaritons, and this whole list of names is everyone who is or has been in Cambridge working on Polaritons. The second part will specifically be about non-equilibrium, and the three names in red are the people who've been involved in the non-equilibrium work. So what I'm going to do with the overheads, I'm going to first explain what microgravity polaritons are, or I'll start by explaining what polaritons are, and then talk a little about the various experiments that have motivated our interest in this. Then I'll introduce the model for polaritons that I'll be discussing in the rest of the talk. And as Victor said, I'll then try and talk a bit about its connection to Feshbach resonance and try and highlight some of the differences as well as the similarities with BEC-BCS crossover and Feshbach resonance. And then at that point, I'll stop with the transparencies and go and talk about non-equilibrium quantum condensations. How can you have condensation when the system is not in thermal equilibrium? So to start at the beginning, what are polaritons? Well, originally polaritons are thought of in terms of the interaction between excitons in some semiconductor, so this is the exciton dispersion as a function of momentum, and bulk photons in that semiconductor. And the point is that if there is strong enough coupling between the exciton and the photon, then rather than getting this crossing, you'll get an anti-crossing. And these states, these mixed state of photon and exciton, are called polaritons. The lower polariton, which I'll keep on calling LP, and upper polariton, rather than the exciton and the photon. However, this, although relatively interesting, is not that interesting, because as soon as you have polaritons, they can relax in energy right down to the bottom of the photon dispersion, and there's no quadratic minimum, there'll be no condensation of any of these particles. So what I'm actually going to talk about is microcavity polaritons. And what's different here is two things. Firstly, the excitons are in two dimensions, and secondly, more importantly, the photons are in two dimensions. So what do I mean by two-dimensional photons? Well, I mean that the photons are confined in a plane by these two Bragg reflectors. So you can effectively think of these as just mirrors. There's a mirror here, and there's a mirror here, and between these there is a photon mode trapped inside this microcavity. And at the antinodes of this photon mode, there are placed quantum wells containing excitons. So the excitons are carefully placed to be at the point where the photon field that is confined is strongest, and so you should get relatively strong coupling between the excitons in the quantum wells and the photon. And what's important about having confined a photon is if I now look at the energy of the photon as a function of its in-plane momentum, then I should get this kind of relation, which for small enough in-plane momentum has a quadratic minimum, and so looks like a boson with some quadratic dispersion and some effective mass.
And what is omega naught?
Omega naught would be the energy of the lowest confined mode, so it's C divided by the size of the cavity. So starting here, where I plotted the wave vector on a logarithmic scale to show you the full range of wave vectors, there's the photon dispersion with some quadratic minimum with a fairly small mass, and the mass is controlled by the size of the cavity, and there's the exciton dispersion, which has a much larger mass and is therefore much slower in increasing. And when you have these two modes strongly interacting, you instead get the upper polariton and the lower polariton. And if I look at the whole range of momentum of this lower polariton, it has some strange dispersion. But these are really quite high momenta. And a better way of seeing this is if the photons are not perfectly trapped by the mirrors, the photons can escape. And as they escape, I can say two things about them. One is that the in-plane momentum is conserved. And the second is that the energy is conserved. Momentum perpendicular to the plane has to change in order to satisfy energy momentum conservation. But that means I can look at the emission coming out, and as a function of the angle the emission comes out and its energy, I can map both the energy and the momentum of the polaritons that were inside the system. And so as a function of the angle that things are emitted, this is the dispersion you can see. And this is all concentrated on this relatively small part of this dispersion. It's, in fact, impossible to see these very high momentum parts, because the momentum involved would be such that a photon being emitted would need too large an energy. So there is some maximum wave vector that you can actually see. But the relevant part is all this part of the dispersion. So having said what it is, why is it interesting? Well, the first...
Can I just ask a question with your last picture? So the dashed thing is before you turn on the cutoff?
Yes.
Right? So in this case, you've chosen the cutoff in the photon frequency to be above the exciton.
Yes.
You presume it has freedom.
You have, you do...
Either way, so you could have a genuine... Rather than this thing that's already
on
each other, you could actually have a genuine...
Yeah. In practice, what's done in an experiment is this cavity isn't perfectly flat. There is some very shallow wedge, because it's not easy to control the exact thickness. And so in order to get some point where you will get exact resonance, they have their wedge, and therefore at some point there'll be exact resonance. Somewhere else there'll be off resonance. The reason I drew it this way around with the detuning is that in all the experiments I'm going to show, when things work fairly well, they are in this case, and there's a good reason for this. If I'm in this case with the photon detuned above the exciton, then this mode here isn't half and half photon and exciton. It's something like 70%, 80% exciton, 30% photon. What that means is it has a higher rate of thermalization, because the photon component undergoes no collisions and doesn't thermalize. So if you have this half and half point, you can see a lot of the phenomena, but nothing really looks thermal. If you go to this case with the exciton detuned below the photon, then thermalization is better. Okay, so the first reason why this might be interesting is that the mass of these particles, the dispersion of the lower Plauerton, is controlled really by the dispersion of the photon. The dispersion of the exciton is practically irrelevant. There's a simple relation between the Plauerton mass and the photon mass. There's just a factor of two. And the photon mass that you get from a microcavity, from a cavity of a length of micrometers, is somewhere between 10 to the minus 5 electron masses, 10 to the minus 4, depending on exactly which material you work with. So this is something which is 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8 times less than an atomic mass. And therefore, you can either try and make the transition temperature 10 to the 8 times higher, or you can make the density slightly lower and still get relatively high transition temperatures. And in all the experiments I'll show in a moment, high TC means something of the order of 10, 20 Kelvin rather than nanoKelvin. The second interesting thing here is that these particles are mixtures of matter and light particles. And so the light that comes out of the system reflects directly the statistics of the particles inside. There is some weight of the Plauerton which is photon-like, and what you measure coming out is that photon-like component of the Plauerton. And so you can directly measure correlation functions just by looking at the photons. So something like time of flight imaging in BEC, in atomic BEC, is done here just by looking at the photons that come out, and their angular dependence is the momentum distribution of the particles inside. And the final thing I want to say here, which is more related to what I'll talk about in the second half, is that this has quite a few similarities to a laser, but it is also quite different to a laser in a lot of ways. It sits somewhere between atomic BECs and lasers, and obviously most like a laser in that it involves photons, but also you can have lasers where the gain medium are quantum well excitons. Those normal lasers wouldn't be in this strong coupling regime where there was this change of dispersion due to the coupling. And so that's one of the senses in which this isn't just a laser, but I'll talk a bit more about that in the second part of the talk.
How many polarization states do Plauertons have? I guess in these two-dimensional cases, in these two-dimensional models, do they have two polarizations?
They have two, transverse and longitudinal, really. There are some subtleties, but the crystal growth is not perfect, and so there appears to be some strain which splits the polarization. So as far as we can tell in current experiments, there is some splitting of about 0.1 MeV, so about 10 Kelvin, so somewhere comparable to the temperatures you're at. So in practice, it really looks like there's only one polarization once you're in a BEC, because it all goes into the same state.
So what's the longitudinal one? Just thinking about light, you'd normally think you'd
It's transverse and...
One of those gets used up, I guess, in the lateral bit.
And by transverse and longitudinal, I mean transverse and longitudinal polarization of the excitons. It really is just two polarization states.
But the light part is still transverse.
Yes, There is, however, a problem, which is why this has been going on for quite a while without, for several years, producing very convincing results, which is that the cavity lifetime is short. That is, the cavities that are built are not very good, in the sense that they're 99.9% good, but you really need 99.999 if you want to say it's equilibrium. And what that typically means is the sort of lifetimes we're talking about are picoseconds. Just to put that number in a more useful scale, a picosecond corresponds to a width in energy, which is about an MeV, or slightly more. It's about the same scale as the temperature. So the line width due to the decay and the line width due to the temperature are comparable, which is why this rest of the second part of this talk is about non-equilibrium. So now, switching to experiments, this is a result from now quite a while ago from the group of Yamamoto in Stanford. What this shows is really three things. One is just that this line here corresponds to emission from the line, from the energy you'd expect for the lower polariton. So it's this same symbol here. And as you increase the density, the emission goes up. So there is some threshold of emission. The second thing is that emission was not at the photon line width, which isn't so much shown here, but it is still strong coupling. It's not that it suddenly turns into a laser and you get emission at the cavity frequency. The second thing that there is around here is the result for a slightly different system, deliberately made to be not so good coupling, where instead what you see is lasing at the photon frequency. And the thing to notice is the threshold there is much higher than the threshold seen in the polariton case. And thirdly, there's this grey region, which is a estimate of at what point does the exciton medium become inverted. So for a normal laser, you expect lasing only once you reach inversion. And indeed, the photon laser is only occurring when the gain medium is inverted. Whereas for the polariton, there is this kind of lasing at the polariton energy without inversion. So the rest of the results I'm going to show you are all from the same paper, from a paper in Nature last year, which shows at the same time a whole series of fairly convincing signatures of something that you really can call a BEC. So what is shown here is what should be fairly familiar to everyone from atomic BEC. It's the same kind of picture. This should just be looked at as a time of flight image, but what's actually measured is the emission versus angle. And this is at power below threshold, this is exactly at the threshold, and this is above the threshold, and you can see this peak developing. What you can do in the polariton case that is not so easy in the atomic case is to, as well as measuring that angular distribution, to measure the energy versus the angle and the intensity at each energy and each angle. And so these are the same three conditions. So what you can see is that it really is that the emission is going down to this low energy point as well as becoming a small dispersion of angles. And what you can somewhat see, but not particularly clearly from this picture, is that this energy moves up very slightly. You might worry whether this means it's going out of a strong coupling regime. It's not in this is a blue shift of about 1 MeV, this change from here to here. And the exciton energy is about 13-14 MeV above this, so somewhere up here. So this is all still strong coupling, and you can see something that's fairly similar to what was seen early in atomic BEC history. The second thing you can do from that previous picture, so this is just a reprocessing of that last data I showed you, is to say what is the occupation of each mode as a function of its energy. And the point of this is two things. It's firstly to show that it's pretty well thermal, and secondly to show that you have something like BEC, where the tail of a distribution stays thermal and particles just go into the ground state. So this figure here is at very low energies, so very low pumping powers. And at these low pumping powers, the densities are low and nothing thermalizes particularly well. But as you increase the pumping power, you get to this point here shown by these red dots, which is just before or just at threshold. And this follows a pretty good Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So at least at this point, you can be pretty certain it's thermalized. As you then go up in power, there's two things to notice. Most obviously, that the low energy modes get macroscopically populated, or get populations much larger than just this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. This is a two-dimensional system, so we shouldn't necessarily expect true macroscopic population of a single mode. The second thing, though, to notice is what's going on in this tail. And firstly, it's staying pretty thermal and it's staying pretty much a straight line. And secondly, if anything, it's getting steeper rather than shallower. And you might have expected it to get shallower, because shallower would have meant a higher temperature. And this is a system you're pumping harder and harder. But actually, as you pump it harder and harder, the effective temperature around here is getting effectively lower. One reason that that's not too surprising is that the temperature that's extracted from here is about 19 Kelvin. The temperature of the cryostat is about 5 Kelvin. So although this is thermal equilibrium, it's not in thermal equilibrium with the crystal. So what's probably going on here is that as you pump it harder, it's actually better able to thermalize because of a higher density, and so approaches more closely what goes on in the crystal. So next I want to turn to the final thing in this experiment, which is about interference measurements. And the interference measurements that you can, at one level, just look at as a simple Max-Ender interferometer. So here is a picture of the signal as a function of this tunable delay for the blue lines below threshold and for the red lines above threshold. So you can see that the coherence is increasing. However, what was done in this experiment was something very clever in addition to this, which is this thing here is not just a mirror, it's a retroreflector. So what that does is, if this is the image that you'd get on this line, after the retroreflector you get this image. So the combination that's seen in the CCD here is this combination of the image plus its inverse. And so what I'm going to show on the next slide is what happens to this image as you change this tunable delay. So as you change the delay, you should expect some interference fringes. And if you plot the fringe visibility at each point, then you get a measure of the coherence as a function of distance, and you get a measure, you get a whole map of what is the coherence function as a function of distance. And so this is what you get if you measure below threshold, and the size of this blob is exactly what you'd expect, it's just the thermal de Broglie wavelength. And here you can again see some sort of blob of thermal de Broglie wavelength, but what you can also see is coherence at longish distances, at distances up to 6 microns, whereas the de Broglie wavelength is about 1 micron. The reason there is this sort of structure here is that the system is disordered. So the actual cloud of condensate is disordered. It fills some trap which you can't easily see other than by looking where the polaritons go. And so the fact that you see any coherence at all at these distances tells you that there is some relatively long-range coherence, and as far as we can see, it appears to be coherence on the same length scales as the whole of the visible cloud of polaritons. So that's what I want to say about experiments. I want to switch now to the model that I'm going to talk about. And the starting point for this is to think about excitons in quantum wells. And the thing I want to point out about excitons in quantum wells in these systems is the quantum wells are disordered as well. Now, the disorder in the quantum wells is all short length scales. It isn't anything which should change the pattern that you see on the micron wavelength. What it does do, however, is what I plotted here is each black dot represents a single exciton state, and this is its energy, and this is its coupling strength to photons. So what you have is at low energies, there are these excitons with energies much below the band edge, but this is the band edge you'd expect in a clean system. And as you increase energy, firstly, their coupling strength to photons goes up, and this is going up because these states down here are very localized, they're very narrow states. As you increase the energy, the state spreads out a bit, and so its overlap with low momentum photons increases. When you get to this point here, you start seeing these states with very low coupling strengths appearing. And what these are is that at some point as you go up in energy, you start seeing states with nodes. And so as soon as you have a node in the exciton wave function, its overlap with a photon goes down. The net result that I want to take from this is that those exciton states which are coupling most strongly to light are exciton states below the band edge, and they're relatively strongly affected by disorder. So in order to understand the coupling between the photons and the excitons, I really want to think about localized exciton states. So to model localized exciton states, I want to make an assumption. I want to describe the excitons as two-level systems. And the reason I'm going to do this is that...
Sorry, I lost the plot, maybe my fault completely. You're talking about localized excitons now. Are you going to introduce something about the extended condensate, which is part of the excitonic later from this?
It will come in why I'm writing down this model of two-level systems.
The usual idea of condensation is that the excitons excrete out of the solution as extended and so on.
What I will also say is that even before condensation, the polaritons can be delocalized, even if the excitons are localized, because you can have a superposition of many localized excitons. So the thing I want to say about two-level systems is that really why I'm stopping at two levels for each exciton is that if I try and stick two excitons in the same localized state, there will be strong Coulomb repulsion. So this is a overestimate of Coulomb repulsion on a site, but it will at least at low enough densities capture fairly well what's going on in the system of localized excitons coupled to photons. So this is just what I said about Coulomb repulsion. It's effectively hardcore here. The energy difference between these two levels means the energy difference between having an exciton and not having an exciton on the site. It's not just the band gap. It really is the energy for having an exciton in that location. So from that, I can then write down this model, which is a generalization of a Dickey model. I have two-level systems, which I'll represent as either a fermion on an upper level called B or a lower level called A, and this is the energy difference between having an exciton and not having an exciton. I can write a term which is just the photons in the cavity, and these have the dispersion I showed earlier. And then I can write a term whereby I destroy a photon and create an exciton by raising something from the lower level A to the upper level B, and I can have a Hermitian conjugate. And the photon dispersion is, just as before, a quadratic dispersion for low enough momentum.
What's the
thing? So A is quantization area, which is just because I've written these as discrete sums. It doesn't appear in any results.
Is there any reason to keep the underlying fermions there?
It's only really convenient. So the exact pseudo-spin can be done in equilibrium it can be done relatively easily by the trick introduced by Popov and Fedorov on them of shifting that Sparrow frequencies. In the non-equilibrium case, I'm going to actually look at this model because the treating them as spins is rather difficult in that case. But it's only really there for convenience.
Are there other interactions in principle where your effective fermions, not really fermions, yes, but the effect of the things that you're representing by these A and B operators can move from one site to another?
Yes, there are two types of things. There could in principle be some hopping term, and there could also be just some direct interaction between one localized site and another localized site. Our estimate suggest those things are not that important compared to this saturation term. But I must admit this is a sort of slightly controversial area. There are some measurements which we think support our results in that if you take this model, one noticeable thing you see is as you increase density, the lower Pollariton energy goes up and the upper Pollariton energy comes down. And if you take this model, the upper Pollariton comes down by the same amount that the lower Pollariton goes up. Now, it's very hard to measure the luminescence from the upper Pollariton at low temperatures because it's very weak. But at higher temperatures, when it has been measured, you see those symmetric shifts. If you put in some term which was just Coulomb interaction between the excitons, that would shift both levels up in the same amount. And that's not really seen in any of the data that's there, but it's somewhat of an open question.
I mean, I guess formally the reason why you're having this representation makes sense. If you build a system so that you have one fermion per site.
Oh, yes, but that's implicit. But when I say it's a fermionic representation of a two-level system, so I should have an additional constraint somewhere that either the lower level or the upper level on each site is filled. So the kind of hopping terms I meant should appear is something where an exciton disappears from one site and appears on another site, which means I get rid of a B and create an A on one site and create a B and get rid of the A on the other side. When I come to the non-equilibrium case, I'll have this model, but I'll satisfy that single occupancy constraint on average. Not strictly, but on average it'll be satisfied. And just to note here that in terms of this representation, the total number of excitations, i.e. number of photons plus number of excitons, can be written in this way. So now I want to turn to talk briefly about analogies between this and Feshbach resonance. And I'm just going to give here a brief table of what those analogies are. So the closed channel resonance level is really analogous to the photon. There is a difference in that we can really measure a photon, whereas it's pretty hard to go in and actually measure the population of the closed channel resonance within a Feshbach molecule. The atoms in the Feshbach case represent the electrons and holes, or what I should probably more carefully say here is represent the two fermionic levels in this fermionic representation of a two-level system. The inter-channel coupling, i.e. the coupling between the atoms and the closed channel resonance level, is equivalent to the electric dipole interaction, so the term which turns a photon into an exciton or vice versa. The background interaction in Feshbach is something we don't really put in, but would correspond to direct Coulomb interactions between different two-level systems. However, as I said a moment ago, one important difference with Pollariton is that you can measure the photons, and in fact, you do and only do measure the photons. You don't go in and directly measure anything about the excitons. And the second difference is we can't dynamically change the exciton-photon detuning. The exciton is fixed by it's fixed by the physics of the semiconductor, and the photon is fixed by the size of the cavity. So you can't do any dynamical changing in these experiments. So the model which this extended Dickey model is most closely related to is the Holland-Timmermans model.
There is another major difference of the Feshbach model, which is that if I really want to do Feshbach resonance on a lattice, then especially in a deep lattice limit, then if one look at the two solution, the two body problem on the well at resonance, one actually cannot say it's one single band. One is forced to have more higher bands to come in. So I think the Dickey model, the different model you use, as I understand it by seeing it, is always in single band, is that correct?
Yes, it's a bit hard to think about the bands of the atoms because they're localized and their energies are disordered. So
when the site index
is
not really on the regular lattice.
No, it's so. There may be some point related to that, but it's not easy to see how to translate it. So just to summarize briefly the Holland-Timmermans model, you have a term which represents the atoms and a term which represents molecules. So these C's are fermionic, these B's are bosonic. These C's are analogous to the A and B that I was writing, and these B's are analogous to the size that I was writing. You have a term whereby the molecules turn into the atoms and back again, and you have some four-fermion interaction directly. And I should probably point out that, as most people by now have realized, for most of the Feshbach resonance experiments, you don't really need these bits. They don't cause any harm, but you can describe most of the results by a model which just has a four-fermion interaction and tunes the energy U. So in that sense, there is a limited relevance of the analogy, because the model that I'm looking at is this plus this plus this, and the model that you really need for Feshbach is, in most of the experiments, is just this plus this. Yes. But I wasn't sure you could explain the whole resonance, across the resonance we've just had.
The first three terms only is a good spatial energy and simultaneous energy delta. And you can
Yes.
Correct way, you'll get the first and the fourth terms. So they're kind
of. Yeah. In doing that, you just have to be careful that in doing that, presumably these Bs no longer strictly mean the population of a closed channel resonance. Because
the population of the closed channel resonance.
Yeah. So what I want to do finally on this thing is to talk a bit about the mean field results. And this will also be useful reminder for what I'll talk about in the non-equilibrium case. And talk about the relation between the mean field results of this extended Dickey model and the results of the Holland-Timmermans model. So for this extended Dickey model, for the model for polaritons, at zero temperature, you can write everything fairly simply in a sort of BCS ansatz, which you can either write just as a coherent wave function, where since these are fermions, if you square them, they come to zero, and therefore I can rewrite this alternatively as something which is more recognizably the BCS ansatz and a coherent photon field. And if you stick the expectation of this, of the Hamiltonian with this, you can find out how to minimize and get the various coefficients lambda and the BCS coefficients here. At finite temperature, instead, what you want to do is integrate out the two-level systems, or integrate out the Bs and the As, and then minimize the effective action with respect to the photon field psi. And if you do that, you get some gap equation, which I'll come back to why the form looks just like this in a moment. But really, the gap equation you can interpret as saying, on this side is the photon field, and on this side is the polarization of the two-level systems. And this says the polarization of the two-level systems is enough to generate the photon field that you needed to generate the polarization. And the energy of the two-level systems in the presence of the coherent field is now shifted. And so if this energy anywhere went to zero, then there would be a gap now. I'll skip that for a moment. So what I want to say about comparison between the mean field theories is that I can sort of draw a continuum between a BCS superconductor, the Holland-Timmermans model, and the model here. And they all can be written roughly like this, where there is some 1 over U effective, there is some integral over the density of states of fermions, and there is some occupation function. However, given that, there's quite a lot of different behaviors that can come out. And the one important difference is that for both BCS superconductor and Holland-Timmermans model in the BCS limit, you're in a situation where the density of states is basically flat. It varies a bit, and the occupation drops to zero quite rapidly on any scale that the density of states varies. Instead, for the Dickey model, the localized exciton states, if I take into account how strongly each one couples to photons, then it's only really those exciton states that were near the band edge or just below the band edge but coupled to photons at all. Everything else is out of the problem. And so typically you're in a regime where the occupation falls to zero quite slowly compared to the width of the density of states. And probably more importantly, this peak of a density of states is somewhere near the photon energy. So the bare photon energy was somewhere around here or perhaps here. And so this occupation is always somewhere in its tail when it reaches this density of states. So what this explains is why there's a difference between the gap equation I wrote before and what you would expect for a BCS picture. For a BCS picture, this integral gives logarithmic divergences cut off at one end by temperature and the other end by the Debye frequency. If I plot this for Holland-Timmermans model, I still get this same kind of cutoff here. And for the interaction, I've got something more complicated, a mixture of the background interaction and the bit that was mediated by the fermions, the bit was mediated by the bosons. For the Dickey model, I haven't put in any background interaction, so I can just write this interaction here, but I can write it the other way up. And this is the photon energy, this is the chemical potential, and this is the exciton-photon coupling strength. But because this density of states is effectively a delta function, which just sits somewhere on this occupation, rather than any kind of logarithmic divergence, I've got this tanh. So this sort of illustrates the kinds of differences you get between the Feshbach picture and this extended Dickey picture. And most of them are really associated with differences of the density of states and the exciton-photon coupling strength. Okay, so at this point I'm going to switch to the blackboard. Were there any questions on the slide before I make them go away? Okay. So what I want to do, talking about the non-equilibrium problem, is I want to start by talking about the model. And but by model, what I mean here is not just the model of the system, which I've already introduced, but also the model of how it's driven out of equilibrium by coupling to Barth's. Then I want to talk a bit about the Keldysh path integral formalism and how it is we're going to treat the Barth's and what kind of results one gets from that. Then I want to talk about the generalization of the gap equation. So the idea is going to be much the same as I summarized in those last few slides, that one tries to integrate out the fermions and then find a gap equation and see what the self-consistent polarization of excitons and photon field is. The most notable difference is going to be that this gap equation doesn't have any easy way of saying whether or not it's stable. In equilibrium, I just minimize the free energy. If it's minimum free energy, it's stable. If it's maximum, it's unstable. Here, because of differences about the path integral, I can't do that. So I'm going to talk about how to work out whether things are stable from considering the excitation spectrum. And then at the end, depending on how much time there is, I'll try and talk about the spectrum in the condensed case and what the non-equilibrium and what the system being out of equilibrium does to that spectrum. So what I described so far for the model of the system is I have this set of two-level systems. And this I wrote as some B dagger B minus A dagger A with some energies of the two-level systems. And I coupled these two-level systems with strength G to photon modes. So this introduced terms which went like G, B dagger A, psi plus emission conjugate. And these were described by the continuum of bosonic modes. What I want to do to drive this out of equilibrium is to couple these two bits of the system to two Barth's and to couple them to different Barth's with different temperatures and different chemical potentials. So for the photons, this is a slightly easier case to see. I can just introduce a coupling where I destroy a photon in the cavity and instead create a photon in the rest of the world. And emission conjugate of that process. So this describes some way of photons leaking out of a cavity. And I'll give some coupling strength psi to this. And for a full model, I'll want as well to have some set of these modes, which will have energies with a continuous spectrum of the energies of these modes, these psi p. So what I'll later do with this is take this bath of modes to be initially empty, and that to be a bath in the sense that I know what its distribution function is, I know what its correlation functions are, because they're not influenced by the system. And then I'll be able to integrate out this bath and get some self-energy which will affect these photon modes. At the other end, what I'm going to do is make use of the fact that I vote these two-level systems as two fermionic levels and do something which is sort of cheating a bit for the model I originally introduced, but does give all the right features that I want. And that's to couple each of these two levels to a separate bath. And what I'll do is to be careful that I'll couple it in such a way that on average either one or other of the levels is coupled, it is occupied, and which level that is I can switch by moving population from one of these baths to the other bath. So what this means in terms of a Hamiltonian is a term, if I write it gamma A, A dagger A, where I destroy a particle in bath A and put, destroy a fermion A here and create a particle in bath A, and there'll be a Hermitian conjugate, and there'll be the same term where I swap the A's for B's. And there should be some set of energies of the bath node here, and the same for B.
So what does, physically, does that represent the excellence of the non-radiating
lifetime? The most important thing it physically represents is that excitons are injected into the system. And if I take this bath here to be at zero temperature and its chemical potential goes to minus infinity so that it's empty, then on its own the system would just decay away into this bath. What I'll do instead is have some temperature and some chemical potential that's not minus infinity for these baths, and therefore what's going to happen is things will flow through the system and decay into the photon bath. So what it physically represents is that in all of these experiments, there's a laser shining which is non-resonant with any of the relevant things you're looking at. It creates high-energy excitons, and those high-energy excitons relax due to interactions with the lattice and eventually fall into this polariton dispersion. But any experiment which says it's steady state is steady state because it has a continuous injection of particles.
Are you assuming that bath A and B are at the same chemical potential? Not
exactly. In fact, this is the thing I want to say next, is when I say that on average I want one of these levels to be occupied and one not occupied, what this really means is if I think about these two levels, if I want some occupation of this and some smaller occupation of this, so I will do this by saying that the bath which couples to this level, its distribution function I could draw like this, where there's some chemical potential for this bath. So this is bath B. And then if I do the same for bath A, then if I want the average occupation to be 1, I want the occupation of this particle to be much to be the other side of the chemical potential. So what I get instead is something which looks like this, where this is minus mu B. So with respect to a zero which is placed in the middle of the exciton level, the chemical potentials of these should be opposite. And then I will, on average, satisfy the constraint that one of the two levels is occupied. And by shifting what this mu B is, I can go from a case where this one is completely unoccupied and this one occupied to the opposite limit.
And in experiments, does one go the whole way from all these levels being empty, all the exitons being empty to being all completely?
No, in experiments, the limit, well, they If you think about all of the exciton levels, you definitely don't get anywhere near complete inversion. If you think about those exciton levels which are sitting near the band edge and couple most strongly to photons, then you probably get to somewhere around 10% of occupation of those.
I mean, this is a bit of a nagging question, which is, one way to handle those sort of hardcore bosons, which are exitons, is just treat them as ordinary bosons, but they're low kinetic potential, so the problems that are hardcore don't make themselves very manifest. That's not a credible way to do it, given the famous Venn figure.
It doesn't seem to be, well, the two answers. One is, in terms of experiment, it's hard to understand the blue shift seen in experiment as being purely Coulomb interaction between otherwise weakly interacting bosons. The numbers seem to indicate there is some saturation effect going on. The other is this sort of admission about the whole of this non-equilibrium part, is if I just made this all bosons, then there's no easy way of doing what I'm going to do. So actually, it makes our life a lot easier that these are fermions. If I write them as fermions, they have some non-linearity in them already, and it's a non-linearity that I know how to deal with. If I put interacting bosons, mean field theory is not going to tell me anything useful about the non-equilibrium problem. And going beyond mean field theory, there's too many possibilities of what I might do. Whereas, at least with this model, it's fairly clear what one might do.
So you're not afraid of having dominant devices of both A and B are occupied with a couple of different paths, and that's the dominant one to respond to anything?
I'm not particularly afraid, because I know what happens in equilibrium. So in equilibrium, I could either solve a model where I put on a strict constraint that exactly one level was occupied, or just put in a constraint on average. And the difference between those two cases in equilibrium is a factor of 2 in the entropy. So it will give temperatures which are a factor of 2 wrong, but all the rest of the formalism works exactly the same in both ways. It may be there's something more complicated that goes on here, but I'm not sure I see how it should break anything more than factors of 2.
Okay, so what's the equilibrium limit? So you just have the same chemical potential for mass A and B, then what happens to the...
The riboid take the equilibrium limit. I'll describe this effective coupling strength as gamma, and this is kappa. Kappa is some combination of these and their density of states. The equilibrium limit, with this assumption here that this bath is at zero temperature, is that I should take kappa to zero first and then take gamma to zero. And I should do that with this bath being thermal equilibrium with any chemical potential here, any temperature. But as long as this is thermal and I take this bath to zero first, then I've only coupled the whole thing to one thermal equilibrium bath and it all thermalizes.
But I could take every bath to be at the same temperature or something. I mean, are you saying that I cannot have an open equilibrium system? I shouldn't be able to...
I could also have this bath at the same temperature as this bath and the same chemical potential, yeah.
Did you just get open equilibrium situation?
Yes. But by saying exactly the same as the equilibrium result, I meant that none of the energies were broadened by decay rates.
Sure.
So then I'd still need to take gamma and kappa.
So the broadening, I think at least, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm always going to think of this bath as being empty and zero temperature, because physically this bath is the rest of the world photons decaying out of the cavity, and the photons in the cavity have an energy of 1.6 electron volts, and there are basically no photons anywhere with energies of 1.6 electron volts. The last thing to say about justification of this is, in a Plaraton context, what this really means is that I'm injecting thermalized excitons into the system. If I disregard all the details of what's going on here, what I get is an injection of pre-thermalized excitons. And that's not too unreasonable to think of in the context of the full Plaraton dispersion. If I say I don't really care what goes on up here, I just care what's going on at these low energies, then I've injected in practice I inject particles way up here at very high energies, and they have some interactions with the lattice and some complicated scattering. If I ignore all of that and just think about what happens at the last moment of their scattering and how they condense or don't condense, then none of that, those details really matter. Okay, so now turning to the second thing about the path integral formalism. I'm going to very briefly summarize what path integral Keldysh is in about two lines. So what path integral Keldysh is a way of calculating a partition function, or really generating functional for any correlation functions. And if I just write it for one boson field, then I do a path integral over some contour C, which I'll define in a moment, of IDT minus H. And the trick is that this contour C is not just a contour from T equals minus infinity to infinity, but is a contour which does this. So it goes up to T equals infinity and then goes back again. Which means that if I actually evaluate this, the answer is Z is 1. I always know that Z is 1 because I took the partition function going this way and I took its emission conjugates coming back and multiplied them together. However, that value of Z doesn't really matter because what I want to do is use it as a generating functional. Then it's always 1, yeah. But it has functional dependence on the values of the fields. So then what I want to do in order to do something useful with this, the first thing I'll do is rather than having a single field defined on this contour, is I'll ignore what goes on at this end and say that I have two fields, a field on the forward contour and a field on the backward contour. And that means that if I use this generating functional to calculate any product expectation like this, then really it gives me some matrix in this forward-backward space, which looks like this. Why this is now useful is that path integrals turn normal-ordered Hamiltonians into time-ordered expectations. And this set of time-ordered expectations have quite useful properties. One is this thing here, with both branches on the same contour, will be time-ordered on this contour, and therefore this is time-ordered. So I can write this diagonal thing as the time-ordered Green's function, and I can write here, well, these are on this field here, which is going the wrong way, so these are reverse time-ordered Green's functions. They have the fields in the wrong order. This function here, however, has this field on the forward contour and this field on the backward contour. And so if I take a contour time ordering, the forward contour always appears first and the backward contour later. Therefore, this really is expectation of psi dagger. It doesn't have any special time ordering. And therefore, I can write that this is a correlation function, which I'll write this way round. And similarly, this is the opposite ordering. Why this is useful is that this thing here, this is the expectation of psi dagger. This is the luminescence. If I think about photons, this is the probability of it emitting a photon. So if I could calculate this, I directly have the luminescence. And since everything that's measured in an experiment is what photons come out of a cavity, everything that I could possibly measure is controlled by just that thing. So the whole of this is really how to calculate that. It is convenient to, rather than using these fields, to make some unitary rotation and introduce fields which are called classical and quantum fields. And the point about these fields is if I took a configuration where the contour, where the result of the field was the same on both contours, then the quantum thing is zero, and the classical thing is just root 2 times the field. So quantum means any deviation between the fluctuations going this way and the fluctuations going this way. Why this is useful is these four Green's functions are not independent. And this becomes quite evident when you write the correlation functions in terms of these new classical and quantum fields. If I...
Is there any... interpretation of these words crossing over the quantum?
Not particularly. Not, there's none that I think are particularly helpful. I'm not really sure. It's not a particularly good terminology to me. But if I calculate these correlation functions, because of the dependence of these Green's functions on one another, then I can write this thing in terms of only three non-zero components. And better still, these two things are Hermitian conjugate of each other. So the point of this rewriting is just to reduce the number of degrees of freedom I have to deal with.
Maybe there is this analogy that if you go to the classical limit, then psi-classical becomes the classical field, or psi-quantum becomes the random force, which we usually add to the classical field.
Yeah. Thank you. So you said you possible to derive a stochastic equation out of this, and you can derive an equation motion for the classical field. And what quantum field does is give you a noise term.
But it's not.
There is both thermal and quantum.
Yeah.
Quantum noise.
So that's why I'm not sure about. I like the terminology because most of the time, actually, what you care about is the thermal noise, not quantum noise.
It is both thermal noise and quantum noise.
So the point of these Green's functions after this rotation, this is just the retarded Green's function, so it has all of its poles in the correct half plane. This is its Hermitian conjugate. And the point about this dk is that it encodes the occupation of these modes. So by encodes occupation, I mean that I can write, remembering that these in general could be matrices, I can write dk is dr times some distribution function minus f dA, and this is basically the Bose or Fermi function plus or minus one depending on which case it is. This can be seen more clearly if I write down what was the luminescence, which is ultimately what I want in terms of these other Green's functions. So the luminescence I can write as a half of the Keldysh part minus retarded minus advance. And if I think of a case where I'm just looking at single field correlations, so there aren't any matrices to worry about, so this F and this D commute, then I can write this as being equal to a half times F minus 1 times dr minus dA, which says something fairly expected, that the luminescence is given by this thing, which is twice the imaginary part of a retarded Green's function, because this is its Hermitian conjugate, which is just the density of states, times this thing, which is the occupation of those states. Now, coming back to this specific model and what I want to do, what I want to do is to take this path and integrate it out in terms of the path integral, so get some partition function after having done the integrals over these fields, and then do the same with these fields. And then I'll have an integral for the system, which will have self-energies which depend on the configuration of the baths. And then I want again to integrate out the fermions and end up with some effective action which just depends on the photon fields. And from that effective action, I can still calculate what this luminescence spectrum is. And I can also derive a gap equation which says when there can be an expectation of a photon field. So in order to do that, I'm going to illustrate how I would integrate out the boson field, but the idea for all the rest of the fields is pretty much identical. So if I write down this contour integral, and I make this rotation, and I've already done the separation into forward and backward fields, then if I look at the bosonic bath, I get the term in the action due to the bosonic bath can be written as equal to some time integral over classical and quantum components of the bosonic bath, with here a inverse Green's function, which looks like omega minus omega over bath p plus I0 some I0 here. Well, I'll talk about this I0 in a moment. Minus omega p minus I0. What I really want to do with this is to do this integral and use it to work out the expectations of psi classical, psi quantum, and so on for the bath. And for the bath, I'm assuming I know the distribution function, I know it's in thermal equilibrium. And what I can then do is take those terms and then stick them into these cross terms here and use that to give some self-energy for the photons in the system. So, jumping back a bit, what I really want to do is calculate the inverse Green's function for the bosons, which are the photon field. And that inverse Green's function, I'm going to write in terms of, I'm going to write this way round, 0k, kr, and kk. And this is the structure which you get after doing this change of fields. There is always a zero here. The relation between these and the correlation functions is relatively simple. The retarded Green's function is just 1 over this retarded function. The advanced is similarly 1 over the advanced function. And because you want the product of this matrix and this to be equal to 0, you find that the Keldysh Green's function must be equal to minus 1 over the retarded part times this Keldysh part times 1 over Ka. So this tells me if I could calculate this inverse Green's function, including self-energy, then I would know what the Green's functions of the bosons were. And I would, for this case, I'd have solved the problem of just the bosons interacting with the bath. So what this thing is equal to, well, if I take just the bare action for the photons, then I get a term just like this, but with omega k instead, because I'm thinking about the momentum of the photons confined within two dimensions. And then I get some term which is this self-energy that comes from coupling between the photons and the bath. And so this is a sum over bath modes. And it has a dependence on this coupling strength here, which this photon bath coupling strength. And then if I think that what these terms reflect is something where there's a photon coming along that has some interaction and turns into a bath photon and then comes back again, this will be the only diagram in the self-energy because it's a fairly simple quadratic theory, then I want just to put here the inverse of this propagator. And there's some subtlety about where these matrix elements end up, but it's fairly easy to understand. You end up with a zero here because you should end up with a zero here. On the retarded Green's function, you end up with something associated with the retarded Green's function. So just the propagator of the bath mode. Here you end up with its emission conjugate. And here you end up with something which depended on the distribution of the bath because it's going to control the distribution of the system. So this looks like 2 pi I, a delta function. And that delta function you can sort of understand as coming from imaginary part of the retarded Green's function times the distribution function of the bath. So in order to make progress with this, let me, rather than dealing with this sum over bath modes with coupling strengths, let me replace this with an integral over bath energies of some effective bath system coupling strength. And let me make a Markovian approximation, which is that this kappa of omega is just kappa. So in this... Yep. Pardon?
Some constant?
Yes. So by Markovian here, I mean that the density of states and coupling to the bath is constant. I don't mean Markovian in quite the same sense as normal quantum optics, because in normal quantum optics, Markovian has a tendency to also mean this distribution function is constant. And I don't assume that, but I am assuming density of states is constant. So when I do that, this whole self-energy term here becomes something relatively simple. These things, well, these will have a real and imaginary part, and the imaginary part will just be, will just come from this plus I zero, will give something which is plus I kappa, and there'll be some real shift of self-energy due to coupling to a bath. But I can get rid of that because I know that the coupling to the rest of the world doesn't shift the energy of the photons in the cavity. That really is just standard renormalization. But the imaginary part is important. So similarly, I get up here, minus I kappa, and here I have a delta function and this distribution function, and so what I end up with here is 2 pi I kappa times the distribution at energy omega. So I have this part of the Green's function and now this extra part. And if I put those all together, if I put all these bits together, I can, for instance, try and calculate what is this luminescence function. So to do the luminescence function, I'd want to work out the Keldysh part of the correlation. Well, if I wanted to work out the Keldysh part of the correlation function, then the only thing which came here, there's zero here, and there's 2 pi I kappa f of omega. So that means that if I calculate this Keldysh part of the photon Green's function, then I get minus one over this kr, which was this bit plus this bit. So omega minus omega k plus I zero. I have the same from ka, which is its Hermitian conjugate, so modulus squared. And then I have this Keldysh part, so I have 2 pi I kappa f psi of omega. If I look at the other part, the dr minus da, that I can write as ka minus kr over modulus kr squared, because they're Hermitian conjugate. So everything will have this same 1 over modulus squared in front of it. And the difference between ka and kr, well, those bits are the same. The only difference is this is plus or minus I kappa. So if I put this all in here, then I get something which is a half f psi omega minus 1 over 2 kappa omega minus omega k squared plus kappa squared. So this is a somewhat complicated way at this point of doing something which you expect. This is the density of states, including coupling to a bath, which gives some broadening kappa and sets the distribution. However, having done that, that's all there is to dealing with this. I just do the same thing again for the fermions, and then do the same thing again for the fermions within the system. And I will end up with some effective action for just the boson field. So I'm not going to go through all of those stages. I'm going to jump now and talk about the gap equation and about stability and what these mean. The first thing to point out about the gap equation is, because of the form of the partition of the generating functional that I've written and have just erased, if I calculate the derivative of the action with respect to the classical field, well, there's always a solution to this. If I take the quantum field to be equal to zero, if a quantum field is equal to zero, then the action can have the same part on the forward contour and the backward contour, and the total action was zero. And it doesn't matter what classical field I took. So this is always equal to zero. So this is not a particularly useful gap equation. What I really want is, therefore, this other thing, which is the derivative of this with respect to the quantum field. And since I know that zero quantum field always solves the equation, then I should take this at psi q equals to zero. So this will now give me some equation. This will now give some, the equation of motion for the system. And what's important is that this is like a normal time, real-time path integral, But the interpretation of this is that if I set this equal to zero, that's asking for adjacent paths to add in phase. It's not anything about minimizing free energy. So I can do this but to work out what the subtle points are, but I can't look at second derivatives of this in an easy way to say whether it's stable or not. To say if something's stable, I really have to look at fluctuations and see if they grow or decay. The second thing to say is that, as is actually the case hidden somewhere in the equilibrium formalism, when I want to solve this equation, I need to make some ansatz for what does the classical field look like. Because in general, it's a sum function of position and time. And the ansatz that I'll make is that it's not a position of function of position, and that its dependence on time is just to oscillate at a single frequency. And this mu s I'm writing suggestively as the system chemical potential, because in an equilibrium case that would be true, that the condensate frequency is the system chemical potential, and that's much more obvious in a Plauerton case where you actually see emission at that frequency, but is also the case for atomic gases. So when I put all that in, then I get some gap equation which has some set of terms which came from this, which I can sort of draw a dividing line here and say these terms come to this side of the equation and describe the cost of having a photon field. And then on the other side of the equation, I have something which came from all the rest of this, from this coupling to the baths, and I can write this schematically as g over 2 times minus I times the trace over of the Keldysh part of the off-diagonal part in AB space of the fermion-Green's function. So what I mean by this is I'm thinking of a 4x4 fermion-Green's functions which has some matrix structure due to A's and B's and some matrix structure due to Keldysh and retarded and advanced components. And this is saying I want one specific component traced over frequency. What this physically means is the polarization of the two-level systems, because it's the superposition of A and B, which means a polarization. And as such, there's always a solution of this equation, which is psi classical is equal to zero, because if there's no classical field, then there's no polarization, so this is zero and this is zero. If I look at the real and imaginary parts of this equation separately, they also have interpretations. If I didn't have any pumping and decay, I'd only have the real part. And what I get is really the gap equation or Gross-Potowski equation, which says that the self-energy of the self-energy, which is, well, it's talking about the real parts of the self-energy, and it's saying that the chemical potential is such that it matches the total energy of the condensate. If I look at the imaginary part instead, then this is talking about the decay rate, and this is talking about the term, the imaginary parts of this, which came from pumping from the coupling to the other fermionic bath. And so the imaginary part is really just a balance of gain and decay. As I'm running a bit behind time, I can either let people leave if they want, or I can offer the choices of, I can talk about the instability of the normal state and how to see whether this is stable, or I can jump to a somewhat completely separate topic, which is, if you're in the condensed state, what happens to the spectrum? So are there any people who want to run away or express a preference? Any preferences?
Stability.
Okay. So for stability, what I want to look at is the spectrum of excitations. If I do this in the normal state, I can understand when the normal state becomes unstable and I have to go to a condensed state. Well, if I do this in the condensed state, I can understand when the condensed state is stable. There is no a priori guarantee that either that solution or that solution is going to be a solution. And in fact, it's true that for some parameters, not necessarily ones related to experiment, but for some sets of parameters with this model, neither this or this is true. So all I'm going to talk about is seeing when this becomes unstable. And so to do that, I want to write down I want to look at the spectrum of fluctuations about the normal state. And schematically, I have this bare Green's function of the bosons. I have the self-energy due to the bath, which I wrote somewhere on the right-hand side of the board. And then if I couple this to the fermions, I can write this as something like trace G delta G, G delta G, where these G's are the fermion Green's functions, and these delta G's are the bits which in the AB space look like GG00, which come from this coupling between fermions, between pairs of fermion operators and photons. So if I do that, then, and jump ahead to formally what the answer is, then from the stuff I wrote over here, I can write down that the luminescence spectrum looks like minus I KK minus 2 times the imaginary part of KR over mod KR squared. And if I do some rearrangement up there, I can say that the system distribution function, so this is the distribution function of the photons, looks like KK over the imaginary part of KR. Why I want to do this is to say that I can interpret zeros of these in various different ways. A zero of the imaginary part of KR means an energy at which the distribution function diverges. And so normally I think of that as the chemical potential. If I have a Bose-Einstein distribution, it looks like this and diverges at the chemical potential. So if I have some energy at which the imaginary part of the retarded part of the inverse Green's function goes to zero, then this is a pole of this function. Similarly, if I think about this equation here for the luminescence, then I can think of zeros of the real part of KR as points where this mod KR squared becomes particularly small. And so that's normally how I think about poles of a luminescence. And so the result of thinking about this is that I can define poles of the luminescence as zeros of the real part of KR. And I can define an effective chemical potential of the photons in the normal state as zeros of the imaginary part of KR. What is then apparent is that although zeros of either of these things on their own do not cause the luminescence to diverge, if both of them go to zero simultaneously, then the denominator of luminescence will go to zero. And so at that point, the luminescence diverges. And this sort of looks like what you expect as you go to a condensed state and the normal state becomes unstable. And I want to connect that idea to two more formal definitions. The first is to say that if that's true, that is to say that there is some energy at which KR is equal to zero, so there is some omega star is equal to mu effective, and I might as well jump to what the answer is equal to this thing I called mu s over here. If that is true, and also zero momentum for photons, then this is in fact this gap equation. And you can see this relatively easily because if I just look at the gap equation near zero field, then I want the derivative with respect to the quantum field of, if I write just the quadratic part of the action, well, the quadratic part of the action has the structure which is the same structure as the Green's function, that is to say, it looks like Ka, Kr, Kk. And so, despite this being some general non-equilibrium problem, the point when this is equal to zero at zero field is, dd psi star of q just brings out this term, and therefore if I evaluate this in the case where psi q is not zero and psi classical, so psi q is zero and psi classical should be allowed to take any value, that just says kr is equal to zero. So I have two things now. I have this hand-waving picture about poles and definition of chemical potential, and I have the gap equation, and they both give the same thing about instability. The final thing to clinch the argument is to say, what do I actually mean about instability? Well, what I really mean is that if I look at kr, then I can write it near some real, well, true pole, actually complex true pole, some value, I'll call it psi p, where this thing really goes to zero. So if I take this pole, if it has imaginary part of one sign, that means this is some excitation which decays. And if it has imaginary part of the other sign, it means it's some excitation which grows. So instability means the point when this pole picks up the wrong sign of its imaginary part. So how does this relate to these other definitions here? Well, these other definitions said that I could write the real part as omega minus omega star, so the real part had a zero at these definitions of omega star, and the imaginary part, well, in general there's some arbitrary ratio here, and it's omega minus mu f. So if I take this form and I want to rewrite it this way, well, I should put in proportional two signs here, then this thing here I can write as 1 plus I alpha times omega minus omega star plus I alpha mu f over 1 plus I alpha. And so if I now look at the imaginary part, so can you still read this down here? I'll move over here. If I write the imaginary part of psi p, then that's the imaginary part of this, then that looks like one term which, well, terms, both terms go like alpha over 1 plus mod alpha squared, and I get one term which is mu f and one term which is minus omega star, where the mu f came from here and the minus omega star came from multiplying by the complex conjugate of the denominator. So what this says is any point where mu f reaches omega star means the same thing you expect it to mean. It means that these poles really do become unstable. And schematically, for the polariton case, I can plot as a function of omega what does the real part of kr look like, and it does something like this. So in principle it has three zeros. However, if I plot the imaginary part, the imaginary part looks something like this, and eventually asymptotes to zero. What this means is that these two points here and here have zeros of a real part and small imaginary part. This one has a zero of a real part but huge imaginary part. And so if I come to using those to plot the luminescence, then I should in principle get peaks here, here and here, but this peak has a very large width and a very small height, so actually it's basically invisible. And you get some lower polariton peak and some upper polariton peak. And if I plot the distribution function, then the distribution function went like 1 over the imaginary part. And so there's some pole of the distribution function here, and it decays. And as you approach condensation, you can see this chemical potential hit the bottom of the lower polariton. So I have still one other thing which I could tell you about if people are interested, which is thinking about fluctuations in the condensed state and what this does to the power law correlations, because this is a two-dimensional system. Or if there are any other questions, I could answer those at this stage.
I think as far as someone in alpha, so we should stop here, and in case somebody wants to hear about it, then we can possibly ask him about this.
I think we're happy with this, unless there are people who really want to hear right now what happened.
Or you can even ask me in private now if there's some set of people who want to.
lot of thinking right now.
Yeah.
And then you can also understand what happens once.
Well, what you can do is you can use this analysis to make it easier to ask a question of whether something is stable. So it's quite hard in general to calculate all of these poles and their imaginary parts for some general condensed case. However, it's quite easy to look at these conditions separately. And since what you want is a coincidence of the two, and since secondly there's a fairly heuristic and probably, well, backed up by numerical results, there's an answer which says that the effective chemical potential, there is only one of it. There's only one place where the imaginary part goes through zero. Therefore, it says if you want there to be another instability in the condensed state, that must mean that the real part must go to zero at the same point the imaginary part was going to zero. And why that's sort of useful is the point where the imaginary part goes to zero is the system chemical potential. The fluctuation spectrum, normally you'd expect some linear Goldstone mode. Well, it gets the effect of decays, but this becomes diffusive. But none of those details really matter for this argument about stability. All that matters is from this normal dispersion, what you'd expect is there's just this one point here where both real and imaginary parts simultaneously go to zero. However, that point is safe because that point is just global phase freedom. And what you really have to worry about is there any other point at finite P at zero frequency with respect to the chemical potential where there is a zero of this? And the answer is
sometimes yes, sometimes no.
If you pump the system too hard, one appears. And what probably happens then, although we're not quite certain, is that there appears to be another more stable solution, or solution which becomes stable, which looks like this with e to the I k dot r, with some finite k condensate.
Briefly, describe the difference between the spectrum with and the usual being, the usual condensate.
Yes. So
in a few words.
Okay. So the trick is that if I write the luminescence, if I think about the retarded Green's function, which is easier, because the luminescence has poles at plus and minus frequency, the retarded Green's function, normally you would expect in a condensate went like omega squared minus c squared p squared and had some linear dispersion. I want to do two things in the presence of pump and decay. I want there really to be a global phase rotation as a symmetry. So I really want that if omega goes to zero and p goes to zero, the denominator of this must go to zero. But I also want to put in broadening. And the only way you can combine these, and also the way that the equations work out if you follow them through, is that this looks like omega plus ix squared plus x squared minus c squared p squared. So that when omega is zero, this is minus x squared and this is plus x squared. So what that means is if I now look at the poles of this, they are solutions of omega plus ix looks like square root of c squared p squared minus x squared. Or be writing omega is minus ix plus or minus I x squared minus c squared p squared. And so the result is that rather than a linear Goldstone mode, the low energy dispersion has an imaginary part which looks like this, and a real part which looks like this.
So you don't have got from more essential. equals zero, you don't have any realization.
Yes, so the problem with the Goldstone theorem here is that Goldstone theorem tells me that I should have some set of modes which continuously connects to the global phase rotation, which I do. I have these modes here, which this line here has arbitrarily small decay rate as I approach global phase rotation. But what's going on is that the real gap equation is something about balance of gain and decay. And if I have balance of gain and decay, the low energy fluctuations are not phase modes which just disperse, they're phase modes which decay in time. And so it's the fact that I have to worry about balancing imaginary parts of self-energies, which says that actually the long wavelength excitations are things which decay rather than things which oscillate.